It is officially recording.
This is December 5th, 2010, and Raina Ingham and Tori Raquel are interviewing Tommy Keda.
All right, what is your name, year, and place of birth?
My name is Tommy Keda. I was born in 1959 in San Luis Obispo.
And how long has your family been in SLO County?
My dad's side of the family came to San Luis Obispo County in the early 20s, and my mom's side of the family came to San Luis Obispo County in the late teens.
How did you become to be a farmer?
I became a farmer in college, or I decided to go into agriculture in college. I started out as a civil engineering major and didn't like the fact that I would be working in a small cubicle, big city as a civil engineer. And one summer during my time as a civil engineer, I remember the sun coming up, surveying a crop that I had planted that was ready to harvest, and I thought that was very satisfying, and that was when I decided to change to agriculture.
What do you produce, and how do you decide what to produce, and where do you sell it?
What we produce is usually decided on what we think we can make money on. We have our core crops that we grow are our oriental vegetables, Chinese napa cabbage, bok choy, baby bok choy, and we grow other vegetables to kind of mix in with that because our buyers want a variety of things. So we also grow different types of lettuces, head lettuce, romaine, green leaf, and red leaf lettuce. We grow celery, cilantro, spinach, parsley, red cabbage, green cabbage, bell peppers. excuse me. And we put in about a 40-acre organic avocado orchard about 10 years ago. And what we decided what to produce basically on what makes us money. The avocados are something different. They don't really mix in well with our oriental vegetables, but the decision was to try to find something that's outside of the vegetables to try to stabilize our yearly income. And the idea was that the price of avocados wouldn't fluctuate with vegetables. So if vegetables had a poor year, hopefully we could balance things out with the avocados. And so we've also considered citrus and wine grapes, which we haven't done yet.
Are you the only avocado farmer in SLO County?
Oh no, we are one of many, but we are one of just a few organic avocado growers. Most of them grow conventionally. And where we sell it, we sell all over the United States, in the South, in Texas, Oklahoma, Chicago, the East Coast, New York, Atlanta. We sell a lot to the Pacific Northwest. We sell into Canada and Mexico also, and occasionally to the Pacific Rim.
Is this just avocados or
all your crops? This is our vegetables. The avocados we sell to a packing house which distributes the avocados all over the country.
And what's the difference in the farming that you do organically with the avocados?
The difference in our organic farming is more in the types of inputs. The organic farming, we're required to have naturally produced or fertilizers that come from nature, either like fish emulsion or manure-based fertilizers. Our pesticides that we use are produced by either a process of extracting something from a flower or a bacteria or an algae, many of which are the same active ingredient that we use in our conventional vegetables. It's just that the carrier or the thing that helps spread the active ingredient over the plant to make it more effective is natural in organic production, maybe like a corn syrup or something like that, whereas in a conventional situation, it's a synthetic product.
To what extent have new technologies, production methods, and consumer expectations altered what you produce and the way you conduct your business?
New technologies, I think new varieties, vegetable varieties, have really had an impact in helping us with disease resistance. Things that maybe we couldn't grow economically without a resistant variety, we can do now just because we don't, say, without a disease-resistant variety, we may only have a 60 or 70% production, whereas with the resistant variety, we can bring that up to 90 to 100%. So it cuts our costs down. We're able to produce and make a profit with a crop that maybe previously we couldn't. For instance, celery, we've had problems with an insect called leaf miner, and it used to be the most expensive crop that we grew, but now with the new pesticides, we're able to produce that at a lower cost, so there's a greater chance of making money and not losing money on it. Romaine is another example where they bred a resistance to a certain disease, which we have in a lot of our ranches, and we weren't able to grow romaine in the past, but now we can go back to growing romaine. Drip irrigation has been something that's really come along in the last 30 years. We used to use furrow and flood irrigation, and we use much more drip irrigation now for a number of reasons. We can produce a better crop. It cuts down on disease pressure. It uses less water. So as far as being more efficient with our water, it really helps. We can fertilize through drip irrigation, which cuts down the amount of fertilizer we use. So I think that, as far as technology, has really helped agriculture. As far as consumer expectations, having the consumer wants a nice, pretty head of lettuce or a head of knop or bok choy, and the customers that we sell to essentially want perfection. And what that forces us to do is to treat things preventatively, as opposed to, say, 40 years ago, a little bit of a defect here and there wasn't that big of a deal. The marketplace would accept small defects, whereas now any defect could mean your product is not marketable anymore. Convenience, packing, and food safety are certain things, or things that the consumers have come to want. Convenience packaging, meaning like the bag salads, that's been a big change over the last 20 years. So it's going to change our cropping pattern. We grow things that they use in the salad mix much more so. Romaine has become a bigger selling item for the convenience packaging than head lettuce was. So it used to be, head lettuce used to be, oh, say 80% of all lettuces grown, and romaine was 20%. Well, just in the last year or two, romaine has surpassed head lettuce as the number one lettuce grown in California. So that's some of the things that have changed. Food safety has also changed the way we do things. You know, we try to instill a culture of food safety in our organization, because out of all the issues around food safety is probably the thing that could put us out of business. In 2007, they had the incidents up in the near the Salinas Valley where spinach was found to have E. coli in it, and that pretty much killed the spinach market for that year. So it showed us that the importance of maintaining a good food safety program, and because it could impact our sales for that crop, but also for other crops that we grow.
Who regulates the food safety?
It's a voluntary program that's in partnership with the government. Okay. FDA, we have FDA Food and Drug Administration inspectors coming out to monitor our fields and our practices and to do spotted inspections on us. We get inspected 2 to 4 times a year. And they come out and make sure that we're using the best practices as far as food safety goes. So it's basically the government monitoring a voluntary program. But if you enroll in the voluntary program, if you don't have a food safety program, you're not allowed to sell your product.
Oh.
So.
All right. Hardly a year passes in California without some talk of water shortages or disputes over water use. To what extent, if any, has this been a problem for you in the past?
Well, who was it? Mark Twain said, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. that is true. We haven't been affected that much here along the coast because most of our water is groundwater. It's been much more of an issue in the valley where they rely on basically water from the Sierras coming through the canals to farm. Where it's affected us is probably just public perception. About 10-15 years ago, there was a lawsuit filed in the Santa Maria Valley where there was kind of a tug of war between who owns the water, the groundwater. The city of Santa Maria wanted to, what they call, bank state water that they had purchased into the groundwater. And the big questions from the farmer was, okay, if you're banking water in there, whose water is it that's running down the river, you know, during a wet season? If they banked over, say, 50 years and they built up the bank account, does that mean that farmers have less water? And so that was an issue that kind of involved us too, because we are somewhat in the same aquifer. But I think the perception is farmers waste a lot of water, but we produce over probably 3 times as much food now with the same or less water than we did 50 years ago. So we've become much more efficient with our water use, and that's partly due to drip irrigation and just through better monitoring of your irrigation. The other thing that affects us is endangered species. For instance, in the Arroyo Grande Creek, water is required to flow in that creek year-round, whereas it never used to. Ever since I can remember, the creek always dried up during the summertime. So because of a lawsuit filed by, I think, the California Sports Fishermen's Association, the county is required to release water year-round. So it affects the amount of water to the municipalities in the South County, because that's their drinking water. And in turn, I think because water for the cities may be a little bit short, they're looking at sprinklers going in the fields and thinking that things aren't fair.
Are there any governmental regulations or laws that have been particularly beneficial or harmful to your business?
Beneficial, I think most regulations have some benefit. You know, the food safety regulations, for one. I think it was a good thing to be able to show that we are doing something for food safety. The Clean Water Act, I think it was good because there was a lot of pollution in the country prior to that. And they used to talk about some of these lakes and rivers in the Midwest or on the East Coast burning because of all the pollution. You know, somebody would throw something burning in the lake and it would catch on fire. So I think it was good, but on the other side, I think a lot of these regulations have gone overboard. As far as Clean Water Act, the Regional Water Quality Control Board, in their latest proposal for irrigated ag waiver, is talking about water coming off our fields in certain aspects being having a higher standard than drinking water. So that's impossible to achieve, basically. You know, you have water flowing off of your garden and it's not going to be drinking water standard. Endangered species is another one. I think it was good to help protect the species, but then at what point is it more important to protect a species or to allow somebody to stay in business, say? Is it more important to protect potential habitat or allow somebody to build a home? And those are philosophical questions that, you know, are tough to answer. You know, it's not really a regulation or law, but these free trade agreements have really not been beneficial to at least the vegetable industry, fruit and vegetable industry. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that was signed, 10, 15, 20 years ago now, hasn't been good for the vegetable industry and a lot of farming. They've helped high-tech industry, the computer industry, the aircraft industry, but usually the countries that we sign the treaty with, their big industry is agriculture. So in negotiations, usually agriculture gets thrown under the bus for higher tech industries. Mexico has benefited from NAFTA in the, as far as agriculture goes, because they've gotten freer access to the U.S. market. Their cost of doing business is a lot less than us. They have lower wages. You know, what they pay for a day's worth of work down there is what we pay for an hour's worth of work. Their environmental regulations are less, so their cost of doing business is less, and so they can compete easier if they have free access to the U.S. market. So it puts American farmers at a disadvantage, and especially California farmers who are dealing with state regulations that are tougher than the rest of the country also. So I think free trade agreements, though they're touted as these great things, I always look at them a little bit differently because of the industry I'm in.
How has the makeup of the San Luis Obispo County agricultural community changed during your lifetime? How would you describe interactions between different individuals and groups in the agricultural community today?
I think the big change in makeup of San Luis Obispo County agriculture in my lifetime has been the increase in the wine grape industry, in the wineries. I think it was back in the 80s, there weren't very many vineyards or wineries in the area. It was mainly cattle and vegetable crops. Now, a lot of the rangeland for cattle, since the cattle industry has been struggling, has been converted to vineyards. And now it's touted that the wine grape industry is the number one agriculture industry in the county. Another big change has been the nursery industry. Cut flowers or other greenhouse operations have become real big. And I think a lot of that is, they used to be located, say, in Santa Barbara or Ventura County. Land prices there have gone up so high that it was cheaper for them to up and relocate their businesses here in this county, where land prices are much cheaper. That's also the same for the strawberry industry. In the last 5 to 10 years, the amount of strawberries being grown in this industry has really taken off. And a lot of that is due to the land prices and rents in Ventura County. For instance, rent for strawberry ground in Ventura County is pushing upwards of $4,000 an acre. They can come here and get a rent for half of that, about $2,000 an acre or less. So that's $2,000 an acre in their pocket automatically just by changing locations. As far as the interactions between the different individuals and groups, it seems to have become a little more contentious, I think. People aren't looking at agriculture as what's best for everybody, but what's best for me, and to heck with everybody else. And I think, for instance, I was talking about the irrigated ag discharge waiver by the Regional Water Quality Control Board. It somewhat split the vineyard groups with the vegetable and strawberry groups. And so I think dealing with issues like that, it's tougher to collaborate. And it takes a little more effort to build up a coalition of all the ag industries. Before, it used to be, for instance, in this county, it was Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau represented all of agriculture. Now everybody has their own little association, the avocado growers, the vineyard people, the nursery growers, the vegetable people, the cattlemen. And so instead of everybody coming under one umbrella, everybody is under their own umbrella now. And so there isn't as much give and take, I guess, is the best way to put it. And also, there's the struggle between organic and conventional. That seems to have, that relationship seems to have gotten worse over time. It used to be, if you want to grow organically or conventionally, it's fine, that's your choice. Now I think it's more of a philosophical thing, and so it's okay if you're an organic grower, you're talking about a conventional grower, while they're the evil, side of the industry, which, I don't agree with. Maybe that's because I grow vegetables conventionally. I think it's more of a marketing thing. I think people that grow organically, they do it for different reasons, and they can do it because they usually sell direct, so they can sell at a premium, and they're customer base is usually a little more affluent, or maybe philosophically are willing to spend more for organic product, whereas we are trying to service the larger part of the population where cost does matter. Maybe this is a bit arrogant, but we like to say we're feeding the country, if not the world. Well, organic product, there isn't enough of it around to ship it to the East Coast during the dead of winter time. And if it wasn't for our type of operation, during the winter time, people in the Midwest or the East Coast, when they can't produce their own, wouldn't have things to eat. But you know, we can grow it cheaper, so we can ship it back there at a cost that's affordable for them. The lower income people, they, for instance, if they spend 20% of their income on food, if organic produce is, you know, twice the cost, all of a sudden they're spending 30 to 40% of their income on food. They would probably skip buying organic produce if that was all there was for something else. So, you know, I think it's been said that it's better to eat fruits and vegetables, regardless of organic or inorganic, than to not. So we are servicing different clientele than they are, and it's really not about who's good or who's bad, who's right or who's wrong. You know, we all service a different niche, I guess.
Do you want to maybe talk about POVI and how that groups
POVI.
You?
Okay, POVI is our sales and marketing co-op, or shipping co-op. It was established in, I think, 1927. It was a merger of two P associations, the Pismo P Association and the Rio Grande P Association. Back then, peas were the number one crop. They were usually dryland farmed, and the peas from this area had a really good reputation. They were in high demand for because of their quality and flavor. And so actually, I believe it was during World War I, the farmers in this area did very well because the quality of the peas was so good that the people in, say, San Francisco area were willing to pay top dollar to get those peas, even though food was scarce. And, you know, it was probably the more affluent sector of the population that was willing to pay for the quality. And so the pea farmers in the area did very well. Well, they merged in 1927 to form Pismo Shano Vegetable Exchange, or POVI, like you said. And the idea was to bring the farmers together to have greater marketing and sales power, and also to be able to purchase things, equipment, well, maybe not equipment, but like seed, fertilizers in a larger quantity to have greater purchasing power too. And so this merger created an organization with close to 50 different growers, you know, all fairly small growers. And it did very well. You know, peas, if you grow peas year after year on the same ground, every year after you start growing, the production goes down. So, after a certain amount of years, people had to transition from peas to something else because the production wasn't that good. It wasn't economical for them to grow. So that's when they started growing lettuces, celery, and different things. And I believe it was 1950 that we really started growing the oriental vegetables. And that's what Povey is known for now. We're known as the number one shipper of Chinese Napa cabbage in the country, if not the world.
Wow, that's impressive.
But during World War II, since all the farmers were of Japanese descent, they got shipped off to camps in the inland areas. You know, Manzanar is the most famous of them. But I think most of the farmers around here were shipped to either Gila Bend, Arizona, or Poston, Arizona. And so a lot of the farmers, not knowing what was going to happen, and since there was a law at that time where non-citizens couldn't own land, a lot of people were leasing land through a Japanese-American citizen. And so they didn't have any assets except for maybe some equipment. And so when the war came, they were shipped off. They basically either just left their stuff and were shipped off to camp or tried to sell whatever they could. But if you know that somebody has to leave, well, you know, you're only going to offer pennies on the dollar. My family was lucky because there was a few families in the Rio Grande area, particularly for us, it was the Loomis family, who watched over our land. We had bought land under my eldest uncle, since he was of age to own land and was an American citizen. So he watched over our land, he leased it out to people, he watched over our equipment. So after the war was over, my family had something to come back to. So that's why my family came back to this area, to San Luis Obispo County, because we had land and we were able to continue farming. It wasn't so for the bulk of the families. Of the close to 50 people who were members of Povey before the war, only 10 came back. So, you know, it got reduced down to about 20%. And just through attrition, farmers either not having children to carry on the business. Povey is now 5 members, my family being one of them, the Hayashi family, the Kobara family, the Doi family, and the Sadowatari family. So doesn't mean the acreage has shrunk, because usually when somebody dropped out, one of the other members generally picked up their ground either through a lease or purchase. And so the size of Povey, as far as the number of acres we grow on, has probably gone up, because instead of being centered around the Rio Grande Valley, now we've expanded into the San Luis Obispo area, Los Osos, and even Morro Bay. You know, we were growing in the Pomo area also. So we've expanded the number of acres we've grown. And the concept is still the same. We try to pull our product together to have greater selling power, to be able to sell to like the Safeways or the Walmarts, the big customers who want larger volumes. Which is a lot tougher for a small farmer to do, because their production goes up and down week to week, and a lot of these customers, the larger customers, will pay a better price for consistency in supply. So banding together has benefited all of us.
So Povey is still as effective as it was back when you had 20 members?
Yes, the concept is still the same. You know, we pull our resources together to have greater selling power. You know, if we were all on our own, especially the smaller farmers, would have a tougher time staying in business, because we're able to draw the customers who will pay a better price because we pull all our product together. We have a larger volume of product available, so they will come to us. They're not going to go, they don't want a hassle with going to 10 different farmers to buy a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. They'd much rather go what we call one-stop shopping. You know, it's like you. If you went grocery shopping, would you want to go to one place to buy your milk, another place to buy eggs, another place to buy produce, another place to buy meats? You know, that's time-consuming and takes a lot of effort and energy. It's a lot easier to go to the grocery store or supermarket, get everything in one place. And that's what a lot of these buyers are doing, is they want to be able to go to one place to get as many of the things as possible.
Are there any other organizations that you're a part of?
Yes. Within the ag industry, I'm a member of the Farm Bureau. I've been an officer and president of the County Farm Bureau in the past. I am a board member of the Grower Shipper Association of San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara Counties. I am on the California Leafy Greens Research Board. Our organization is a member of Western Growers. I am an honorary member of the Boys and Girls Club of South San Luis Obispo County. I used to be a board member, but just through my busy life, I've had to drop things, so I'm more of an honorary board member. The Five Cities Youth Basketball League, I help out there. I've been coaching there for 28 plus years. I've been on a lot of other boards and committees, but there's only so much time, so you have to kind of prioritize things. I've got a 12-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old son who are active in sports, and I dropped a lot of things so I can spend more time with them, either going to their games or helping to coach their teams. So I've had to readjust my priorities from time to time and had to drop certain things. I've been on the San Luis Board of Education's what they call P16 Council to look at an overall strategy for education.
You're very involved in the community, goodness.
Well, and that's one thing that has been somewhat instilled in us, and it's a philosophy of my grandfather and grandparents. You know, the community has been good to us, and so we should look to give back to the community in whatever way possible. I think all of my cousins participate in some way or another. Raina probably knows yeah. this, but, you know, we've been on different community organizations. We participate and donate to a lot of community organizations. Garrett's dad and uncle helped restart the youth basketball program in the Five Cities area. You know, it's just something. I'm not sure if I should say it's expected of us, but it's encouraged of us, and it's something that I guess since we've been brought up doing it or seeing our parents do it, that it's something that we want to do too. You know, my family's been in this area there's four generations now, so you know, we're very much a part of the community, and we want to be an active part in making that community better. So,
definitely,
yeah.
Sounds like it.
In what ways has population growth and urban development on the Central Coast affected the local agricultural community?
A lot of these big philosophical questions.
I'm sorry.
I think the main thing is with population growth and this being such a great place to live, that when I was a kid growing up, everything revolved around agriculture, especially in the South County, the Five Cities area. So if agriculture had a poor year, almost everybody had a poor year because the majority of the population were somehow associated with agriculture, whether they were working in production agriculture or for a support industry or relied on the people who worked in agriculture as their customers. So if ag had a bad year and the income wasn't there, well, it trickled down through almost everything. And I think in that respect, there was a lot greater support for agriculture back then because everybody went up or down with agriculture. They were, you know, they had a stake in the industry, basically. I think over the last 40 years, there's been a lot of people who've come into the area since it's such a nice area. A lot of urban people from Southern California, the Bay Area, and they've brought a lot of diverse industry here. A lot of people have retired here, which is good for the local economy as far as bringing diverse industries in that the economy is more stabilized. But it's also brought in a lot of people who don't understand agriculture or have their own ideas about agriculture and complain about noise or dust or complain about mud on the roads from, you know, our trucks and tractors having to drive on the roads. Things like that. It seems like it's become more, hey, we love to look at your fields, but we don't like you starting up your tractors at 6 o'clock in the morning because we're trying to sleep. We don't like you disking a field when the wind is above 10 miles an hour because the wind is blowing in our direction. We don't like, you know, whatever, like I said, mud on the roads because we're driving on the roads and it's dirtying our windshields when it rains. But those are things that in years past, you knew that it was a part of agriculture, or at least the bulk of the population knew that it was a part of agriculture. And so it was just accepted as, okay, you know, if you want to live in a rural area, this is some of the things you deal with. Now, what do they say? There's probably 5% of the population of the county who is involved in agriculture, whether it's in production or a support business. It might be a little bit more than that, but you have 85-90% of the population who don't. And the big impact is they have the votes. Yeah. So they can say, we don't like this, we're going to make you, or we're going to we're going to pass an ordinance saying that you can't do certain things. You can't, I'm trying to think of an example. Well, for instance, like in the vineyards, they have what they call these noise cannons to scare away birds. Well, neighbors complain about that. And so you can't shoot those off after a certain time, but then you can't go out there and shoot the birds either. So what do you do? Mm-hmm. Pretty much the birds come in at night and eat your grapes or whatever. And so it has an impact. So just because of the larger urban population and their I don't mean to use the term ignorance in a bad way, but they just don't know about agriculture. It's had an impact on agriculture.
Do you think there's any way to educate the urban population about what it's like to be a farmer?
I think farmers in general do a very poor job of that. You try, but I think what they say is in the United States, people spend maybe 10% of their income on food. So it's, things don't really hit people until it hits them in the pocketbook. And with cheap food, it's easy to say, okay, you can have that NIMBY attitude, not in my backyard. You know, we don't want you to do things here because it's affecting our quality of life. So we don't care if they're doing it in Santa Barbara County or in Mexico. We just don't want it here. Well, if it doesn't affect the cost of food for them, or if it doesn't affect them in their pocketbook or in their business like it did in the past, you know, it's not a big deal to them. I shouldn't say that so definitively, but that's my feeling. Unless it hits somebody in the pocketbook, they really don't care. You know, there's been a lot of land use ordinance passed where it's making it tough to continue farming with the regulations that are happening, but you can't change from agriculture. And as long as somebody can look out the window and go and say, oh, you know, look at this nice open space, they don't care. For us, it's not open space. For us, it's our lives, it's our business. And so it matters to us if, say, the Endangered Species Act says, okay, hey, you know, you have tiger salamander habitat on your ground, on your farm, you can't farm anymore. But the land use ordinance says you have to keep it in agriculture or nothing. You can't develop it any further. Well, what do? One law says you can't farm, and the other law says you can't do anything but farm. You can't develop it. So it puts you in a tough spot.
And is most of your land zoned just for agriculture?
Most of our land is zoned just for agriculture. I think it's all under a conservation easement called the Williamson Act, which basically, usually property taxes are assessed as to the highest use. So that's why residential taxes are a lot higher. The Williamson Act taxes you at the current use, which is agriculture. So your tax level is a lot lower. And that's helped to keep farms in business. You know, if we were taxed on the development potential, it'd be tough to stay in business because our taxes would be 10, 20 times higher.
Especially in this area.
In this area with, you know, the you know, how people want to live here. Mm-hmm, I mean, it's right. A great place to live. It's in a conservation program, but because of the budget crisis in the state, that conservation program wasn't funded. Usually the county, it's administered by the county, but the county gets so much back from the state for their loss in property taxes. It's not 100%, it's a certain percent. It's called the subvention funds that go back to the county. The state cut that from the budget last year, so there's a lot of counties that are getting rid of the Williamson Act conservation program, which means it's going to be a lot tougher for farming to continue in those areas. And it's going to have an impact on a lot of things. A lot of people live here because of the rural character of the area, and if you make it tougher to make a living in farming, that rural character is going to go away, and it's going to have a long-term impact on why people live here. You know, once farming goes away, it's real tough to get it back. You generally don't bulldoze strip malls or homes to put it back into agriculture. So, and I think as far as people not wanting, or people don't react until something hits their pocketbooks, this is a longer term vision of what could happen. So it's not right in front of their face. So it's not something people think about. You know, right now they're thinking about balancing the state budget, and they don't realize the impact it could have for other things that they do value. That's a long-winded answer. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm just making sure.
Can you tell us a little bit about what a typical day on your farm is like?
Oh, a typical day on our farm. I'm assuming you're talking about our main main growing season, not this time of year. This time of year, it tends to be kind of slow. Crops aren't growing as fast. We don't have to irrigate as much because it's so cool. The days are short. During the summertime, though, that's when things get going. Just kind of an overview of the year before I get to the day is, I like to think of it as a run. You have your warm-up period. This time of year, okay, we're in our warm-up period. Maybe we're like just a gradual stroll to loosen up. And then, you know, in a few months, it'll get to be more of a fast walk. And then come March or April, well, it might get to be a jog. Then we get to June, July, August, when the days are longer, a lot more things are going on. It becomes a fast run to a sprint. And then you have your cool down period as, you know, days get shorter, and it goes back to a jog, to fast walk, and then this right now is kind of like our slowest time of the year. So it's more like a crawl or just a casual walk through the park or something like that. But during our busy times, typical day is we'll start usually around 6:30 in the morning. My day starts a little bit earlier. I'll usually get there earlier and meet with my foreman, and we'll go over kind of how the day goes or how we envision the work going for that day. And usually in the mornings when it's not windy, you know, since we grow right along the coast, you usually have the afternoon winds, that's when we'll do our sprinkler irrigation. Usually that's for right after transplanting, or right after planting seed, we will sprinkle to bring up the crop or to set the transplants. So we'll try to do that in the morning when there's no wind, because we get a lot better uniformity, greater efficiency in the use of our water. You don't end up with these big dry spots later on in the day. And so our irrigators... Do you want to change your pen?
Yeah, it's okay.
But it's usually the busiest time of the day for our irrigators. And prior to the workers starting work is when my foreman and I will kind of figure out, okay, we need to get these things done as far as tractor work. Okay, we're going to have this guy do these things. This is going to be his schedule for the day. So the guy, okay, we're going to have him do these things. And we usually try to schedule it so everything is efficient. We don't want them moving from one end of the ranch to the other end, or to have to change operations, which means changing equipment that we use that is basically downtime. So we'll figure, okay, if you're going to be disking, you're going to go from here to here to here to here. And those are the things that we need to get done for that day. And we do that with all our operations and all our tractor drivers. We kind of go over what is going to be harvested for the day. And kind of the same thing, okay, this is how it's going to go. They're going to move from this crop to harvest this many packages to this crop. And so we can set up our equipment for harvest in an efficient manner and make sure that the crew isn't waiting for something, whether it's cartons or trailers to load on or tractors. And so they don't have the downtime. Downtime costs us money because they're not being productive. So the more we can structure things so they're just flowing from one job to another, the better it is for us. As far as the harvesting goes, most of our harvesting is on piece rate, and it's better for them also because they can flow smoothly from one field to another without having to jump back and forth too much and having a lot of travel time, which they're not getting paid for. They can spend more time earning money. So that's what we do before, and after the day goes, everybody goes off to do what they're scheduled to do, and basically it's just monitoring things from there on, seeing what the progression of the work or how it's going, if there's any adjustments that you need to make. Maybe you're going to be transplanting the next day and you need to get a field ready for transplanting, and so that is the highest priority. Well, if a piece of equipment breaks, then you have to go to plan B, and that's where myself and my foreman come in, that okay, this happened. Well, it's a high priority job. What do we do to make sure it gets done? Whether it's throwing more people into that job, borrowing equipment, and if you're throwing more people into that job, well, that's going to screw up the schedule for other things, and you've got to make a lot of adjustments during the day. So that goes on all day long, basically. How did somebody put it? The first part of the day is usually scheduling and putting out fires, you know, things that go wrong. Usually by the afternoon, everything, you've put out the fires, things are kind of going along. You basically start planning for the next day. That's the time when, you know, everybody is trying to wrap up what they need to do for that day. If there's time, they'll get started on stuff for the following day. Our irrigators will be setting up fields to irrigate for the next morning so that they can start the water, especially the sprinklers, as early as possible to get the longest amount of sprinkling time without wind. We'll also set up our irrigations for the evening because the winds die down in the evening, so we'll also, you know, do some irrigation in the evening. But everybody's wrapping things up, making sure that, okay, what needs to get done gets done, and my foreman and I usually start to plan for the next day in the afternoon. You know, you kind of know, okay, we've done all of this, they're working on this, they should finish this much. We need to finish up in the morning, or they're going to finish, okay, so we can move on to the priorities of the next day. And then you start to set those priorities and schedules from the afternoon before for the next day. So it's kind of a constant cycle.
Great. How many people are working on your farm a day?
We've got two different types of workers. We have our full-time workers that we employ ourselves, and we try to keep busy year-round. And for the more seasonal jobs, we will hire through a labor contractor. And like at this time of year, we may have 15 to 20 people working on all our ranches. During the peak time, we may have over 100. Especially if we're harvesting a number of different things. We have a number of harvesting crews. You know, it could be as many as 150 people if you're harvesting four or five different things that have different crews. Plus you have a transplant crew transplanting. Plus you have a weeding and thinning crew out there. Plus your own full-time workers. So I think at peak it could be up to 150 people.
And what is the greatest challenge you have faced as a farmer?
You know, it kind of boils... I guess I look at things in the big picture, and from my perspective, it's public opinion. Public opinion drives a lot of things that we face today, the laws and regulations that we face. And like I said about influx of population in the county, there's more people who have a disconnect from agriculture that don't understand what it takes to produce a crop, to stay in business. And so they don't understand the ramifications of the laws that they support. You know, not to say that the laws are bad, but it may be the details in that, those laws that that could affect us. Maybe it could have been worded a little bit differently where it doesn't have as great of an impact to me, or in my business, I should say, to me. So I think the greatest challenge that we in agriculture face is educating. Now, you asked about educating the public. Most farmers would rather be out in their fields. You know, I mentioned I was involved in Farm Bureau and Grower Shipper and a lot of these things. I was much happier before that because by my involvement, I see what's happening. Usually I know about what legislations and regulations are being worked on as opposed to actually becoming law. So a lot of times that process takes years, and so I see it coming down and how it's being formed over years. Whereas before, I didn't know about it until it became law and I had to deal with it. And ignorance is bliss. If you don't know about it, you just go about your business and not worry about it. And I think since I do know what's going on, or I am more aware, it stresses me out more because I see it starting and going through the process. But then also it gives me an opportunity to influence things too. You know, county ordinances, if I know that it's being written and something is coming down, I have the opportunity to try to influence how it's written and to educate the decision makers or the people drafting the ordinance as to why certain language is better than others or why it's worse than other language, and I have a greater impact. And that's why I am involved in these organizations, to have an earlier impact and a greater impact. Once it becomes law, there's not a lot you can do. You know, you just have to live with it. And but you're much happier in those years until it becomes law because you don't know about it. So educating the public and educating decision makers is probably the biggest challenge, I think.
Well, hopefully these interviews will help educate the public a little bit.
I hope so, too.
And change public opinion.
That's why I'm usually more than willing to do stuff like this or speak in front of people. You know, most farmers that I know don't want to be interviewed by a TV reporter or a newspaper reporter. You know, they'd rather just go about their business. But in my mind, okay, you know, I can talk to you two, but I'm just hitting two people. If a reporter comes and asks me, hey, would you be willing to talk about this? I jump at the opportunity because all of a sudden I'm talking to one person, but I'm reaching out to thousands.
Right.
So, you know, I think things like that are important, and I wish more people in agriculture would do it.
Our last question. What do you think the future holds for agriculture in the Central Coast?
It depends on the mood when I wake up. You know, I'll have to admit, there are days when I wake up and I'm pretty cynical and pessimistic about the future of agriculture and think that, gosh, you know, maybe I should push my kids into a different business. You know, they're going to be struggling if they go into this. And there are days where I think, you know, I think people are going to come to awareness of the importance of agriculture, and, you know, agriculture's going to have a good long life in this county. I think agriculture will continue for a long time in this county. How it continues, I don't know. I think technology will come about to help with that. You know, what was it I saw earlier? California is the worst place to run a business because of all the regulations and things. You know, it does cost more to do business in California and to farm in California, but that's where I think technology and places like Cal Poly and UC Davis and the other ag schools will help, especially since they're located in California, know the issues that we face. Technology will come about to help us reduce some of those costs and keep us on the cutting edge of agriculture. But I do think it's going to take a lot of education to make people aware of the importance of agriculture. The difficult part that farmers have is they love to go in the coffee shop and talk to their buddies about basically a bitch session, you know, just complaining about this or that. And, you know, what they say to their fellow farmers sounds great to their fellow farmers and to them, but when you're trying to talk to somebody who has no clue about agriculture or knows very little about agriculture, the way you present things has to be different. You know, like I said, until it affects them, they really don't, I shouldn't say care, but they don't care as much. And so you have to present things in a way where they realize how it affects them. And that's where I think most people in agriculture do a real poor job. And that's something that I'm hoping will change. And I think it needs change. But I do think that, at least on the Central Coast, people value agriculture for different reasons. They may not be good reasons for agriculture, but they value agriculture. So I think educating them may be easier than, say, somebody living in downtown LA. I think since they live in what's pretty much a rural county, they see value in agriculture, and so that's why I think agriculture will stick around. I'm just not sure what it would look like in the next 20 years.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for sitting down
with us. No problem. No problem.
Definitely learned a lot.
I know.